Okay. Well, let's summarize what we saw yesterday. We spent some time looking at reasons to believe that God exists. Then we spent quite a bit of time looking at evidence for Jesus. I think that was encouraging stuff. We saw the claims of Jesus. We looked at the historical examples of people mentioning Jesus. We saw the fulfillment of prophecy and the reasonableness of believing in the resurrection. And then we went on and we talked a little bit about the inspiration of the Bible. We talked about how we can trust the sources for the Bible, the canonization, the manuscripts. And we talked a little bit about the inspiration of the Bible and the idea of the Bible being perfect or inerrant. Towards the end of that, I started skipping a lot. So I want to go back and do some review. But before I do, some questions came in, so I need to answer the questions. All right, so can you compare interpolations and Revelation 22, 18 through 19? I assume that's the part where it says, do not add to the scriptures. Now, let me ask a fun question. Which would be worse, to add to the scriptures or to take something away? No, which would be worse, to add or take away? Adding would be worse than taking away. Because you could take one of the 66 books in the Bible away, and we'd pretty much have the same thing. So adding to the word is worse than taking away, arguably. But these interpolations, such as in John 8 and 1 John 5, nobody was purposefully and willfully adding to the scriptures. It was probably done accidentally. All right, so just things happen. So I don't think I would apply Revelation 22 and say these people are going to hell because they did that. I think it literally happened because of an accident. And besides, even if it wasn't accidental, and even if they're only trying to give extra explanation, what they're not doing is trying to say something that's biblical, that's false teaching. All right? So next, how do we answer someone who asks, this is a classic one, if God created everything, then who created God? That's a classic, you know. All right. Well, first of all, God was not created. And God, by definition, is the uncreated one. He's the, forgive me for using this fancy language, God is the uncaused cause. And one thing that seems... You exist, I exist. Another thing that seems... I'm going to talk about science and Christianity later today. We're going to learn a little bit about the Big Bang model. Okay? And according to the Big Bang model, when the universe was created, not only was mass and energy created, but even time itself was created. So if you asked what happened before the Big Bang, that question is meaningless. Because even time came to existence at that time. You can't go backward from there. So God, by definition, is the uncreated one. And in fact, how does God define himself? He says his name is Yahweh, which means I am. Remember, Jesus didn't say before Abraham was born, I was. Jesus said before Abraham was born, I am. So God is the self-existent entity. All right, so why does God exist? He just does. It's apparent that he exists, otherwise we wouldn't be here. So who created God? The answer is not to put down the person asking the question. That's a nonsense question. Not that it's nonsense for the person to ask, but that question literally doesn't even mean anything. Because God, by definition, is the uncreated one. All right. So what if somebody's suffering and then they have a sinful response to that suffering, okay? For example, why would God call me into account for my deeds if I didn't choose... Oh, no, those are tips of questions, okay. So what if a person has made a sinful response to suffering? Asks, why should God call me into account for my deeds if I did not choose to be born anyway? I did not choose to live a difficult life. Why should I feel that I owe God any gratitude for wanting to save me if He chose to create me in the first place? And the answer is, you don't have to. Aren't you glad that God created you so you get to choose if you're going to love Him or not? So the answer is, you don't have to. So if you don't want to love God, then don't. Okay? Now you need to understand, though, that there are consequences. If you don't like the consequences, all right, fine, just say, too bad, you know, but it's not really going to work. Let's say you say, I don't like the law of gravity. Why did God make gravity? I don't agree with gravity. I reject gravity. All right? And then you step off a cliff. Okay, you know, go ahead and reject gravity. But the fact is that God made you. You know, as a child, you could say to your parent, why did you bring me into this world? You could do that if you want. You could refuse to love your parents if you want. All right? But the fact is, the reason your parents brought you into the world was not to make you suffer. The reason your parents brought you into the world is because they wanted to love you and they wanted you to have good things. And that is true as well. Now, somebody in this situation clearly has suffered a lot. So I personally wouldn't want to go jump down their throat, tell them, why are you thinking this, you terrible person. I think somebody like that needs a lot of compassion. They just need a hug. They need to know that you love them. So I would agree that it definitely is a sin to say this to God. All right, I agree with that. It's to reject His love. But two things. Number one, good luck going in that angle, you know, of saying, forget you, God, blah, blah, blah. Because the bottom line is whether you like it or not. This is God love you. Number three, let's show compassion to that person. All right, anyway. So I did a lot of skipping towards the end of that last class yesterday. So I want to go back and kind of do a little bit of, cover some things that we didn't do. For example, I mentioned the Old Testament Apocrypha. And a lot of us are kind of aware of it, but don't know much about it. The point I made about the Apocrypha, the Old Testament Apocrypha, is that if you read the Apocrypha, and please do it, right? Find a Catholic friend, borrow their Bible. They're probably not using it anyway. Ha ha ha. Just kidding. Just kidding. And read the Apocrypha. And what you'll find is it's kind of because when you read something by people who they say it's inspired but it's not, and you go, yeah, obviously it's not. Okay? So here are some of the books in the Old Testament Apocrypha. Actually, it's all of them. Tobit, Judith, etc., Baruch. And let me just say just a very few things about these. Okay? Tobit, Judith, the additions to Esther, Susanna, Bell, and the Dragon. These are all fables. And I'm telling you, when you read these things, you're going to say, this is a fable. All right? And then when you read the true accounts in the Bible, you go, all right, I can see. You know, because people say that Jonah is a fable. But when you read Jonah, it doesn't come across as a fable. But if you read Tobit, they're using smoke from the liver and heart of a fish to drive off a demon. All right? Susanna, you have Daniel as a young boy. If you read the stories about Daniel as a young boy, you kind of go, no, no, this is not true. In Bell and the Dragon, Daniel could, you know, it's interesting stuff, but it's not. It's obviously not inspired. If you read 2 Maccabees, I think I mentioned this quote at the end of 2 Maccabees, says, I'll bring my own story to an end here too. And if it is well written and to the point, that's what I wanted. But if it's poorly done and mediocre, that's the best I could do. Can you imagine that after the Gospel of John? I mean, seriously. There are a number of historical inaccuracies in 2 Maccabees. By the way, 1 Maccabees is very accurate historically. I literally know nothing about 1 Maccabees that would say it's not inspired. It's the only ones in the Apocrypha that, to me, I don't say, obviously not inspired. So maybe it's inspired. I don't know. Did Paul write inspired books that aren't in the Bible? I'm sure he did. All right? Not every inspired thing ended up in the Bible, so who knows? Maybe 1 Maccabees is inspired. All right, and then there's Ecclesiasticus and wisdom. These are kind of like proverbs. And there's some pretty cool proverbs, like some that I suppose could be true. Envy and anger shorten one's life. That sounds good. Worry brings on premature age. One who is cheerful and gay while at table benefits from his food. That's good. But then there's things like this. Tell nothing to a friend or foe. If you have a fault, reveal it not. That seems to contradict some scriptures in the Bible. What do you think? And again, remember we're talking about supposed contradictions in the Bible. And there are none. But when you read these other books, you kind of go, you're scratching your head, right? Here's another one. For kindness to a father will not be forgotten. It'll serve as a sin offering. All right? In other words, your good works will forgive you of your sins. I don't know. That seems like a contradiction to me. All right, here we go. Water quenches a flaming fire, and alms atone for sins. Do you see why the church wants to include this in the Bible? By the way, the history of the Apocrypha is interesting. The Jews never included it in their Bible. Never. It was the early church that did. Jesus did not ever quote from the Apocrypha, neither did any other New Testament writer. There's one place, Jude, where Jude seems to reference 1 Enoch. He doesn't quote it directly, he kind of refers to it, and that's it. But by the end of the 2nd century, the church fathers were quoting the Apocrypha extensively. And by the 4th century, they were treating it as if it was scripture. But it's not, okay? And then Jerome, who produced the Vulgate translation in the end of the 4th century, included it, not because he wanted to. Jerome was one of the greatest scholars of the early church. He was well aware that these should not be in the Bible. He refused to do it, but they wouldn't let him. They forced him, essentially, to include the Apocrypha, so it got included at that time. All right? Here's another one that I think probably isn't very good scripture, but then it's not scripture. In Sirach, worst of all wounds is that of the heart. Worst of all evils is that of a woman. Oh, wow. There is scarce any evil like that in a woman. Maybe she fall to the lot of the sinner. Ouch. Okay. So you see, now again, that's kind of funny, but what I'm trying to illustrate is we should be confident in the inspiration of the Bible for many reasons. But one reason is if you read the supposed alternatives, they're obviously not inspired. Okay, got it. All right, and then there's the possible additions to the New Testament. Remember I mentioned that? There were a very small number, 3 or 4, very, very, very early letters that were considered worth reading in the church. All right, and that's okay. It's worth reading my book from Shout to Reality. Go ahead and read it. Not inspired, right? But as you read some of these, again, you'll realize, oh yeah, I can see why they're not included. If you read the Epistle of Barnabas, there's allegorical interpretation of the Old Testament that's not justified. Strong anti-Semitic attitude. Not good. All right, I could give some more examples. What about those other Gospels? Obviously not. Remember we said someday there's many, many different gospels. And, you know, the Orthodox Church threw out the ones they didn't like. That is so not true. Let's look at some quotes. The Gospel of Thomas. Let Mary go away from us because women are not worthy of life. And then it has Jesus telling people which is blatantly Gnostic. Blatantly. That to compare is silly. It talks about Etchemoth is one thing and Etchemoth another. Etchemoth is wisdom simply, but Etchemoth is the wisdom of death, which is the one who knows death, which is called the little wisdom. It's like, ah! All right. So you can see what I'm included. I have a bunch of material trying to compare, you know, the claims that other writings are inspired, such as the Quran or the Baha'i scriptures or Hinduism. I wish I had time for that. It's kind of interesting, kind of fun. I need to kind of move on. I'll just say this. The inspiration, in quotes, of the Quran to the Bible is really quite silly. And Muslims say the Quran is perfect. What they will not do is consider any evidence. They refuse to even discuss the evidence. Literally, they won't even discuss it. All you know, my is probably don't waste your time engaging in these useless discussions. They care about the truth, honestly. A Muslim who is a reasonable person who actually will respond to reasonable questions. But the problem was when he tried to present evidence the Quran is inspired, all he had was numerology. All times there's 19 things in the Quran. That was his only evidence. I'm serious. That's all he had. Alright? And you have to be aware there's a reason Muslims go after the Bible. Because in the Quran it says that Jesus is a prophet. Right? And therefore, everything he says is true. Right? It also says that Jesus wasn't raised from the dead. And that he never claimed to be God. Well, that's a problem. Because clearly... So they say the Bible is corrupt. The Bible is so corrupted that all the accounts of the resurrection are made later? When? When was the account of the resurrection added to Luke? Do they have... Absolutely. So it's an argument based on literally nothing. But it's essential because... If the Bible is inspired, and by the way, the Quran says the Bible is inspired. It says it. It calls it the Injil. The Quran says the Bible is inspired. It says it, I'm telling you. The Bible clearly has Jesus being God, all right? So if the Bible is inspired, then obviously the Quran is not. So that's why they have to go after the Bible. Okay? Anyway, so I've got all this stuff. It's cool stuff, but it's just way too much material. Oh yeah, another thing is, one of the doctrines of Islam is the doctrine of abrogation. In other words, if Muhammad said something at a later time that contradicted something that was said before, the later thing cancels the thing that came before. Well, what's that say about the thing that came before? That it wasn't true. So the Quran itself literally says that not all the Quran is inspired. All right? So, and there's many areas of abrogation. It's a little bit scary because the very early period of the Quran, Muhammad is so nice and he says, oh, Jewish people are wonderful and Christians, they're so great. And later on, he's saying we need to basically take these people out. All right? And the theory of anyway. Now, I was talked about supposed contradictions. All right? And I wanted to look at a couple more examples because there are a lot of claims of contradictions, and a few of them I think are probably worth. Let's go to Matthew 2:23. So was fulfilled what was said through the prophets, who would be called a Nazarene. Now there are several quotes of prophecies in Matthew that the skeptics of the Bible say there is no prophecy there. All right? And so that would mean that Matthew is wrong. All right? But the problem is these people are the ones who are wrong. Now they say there that Jesus is a Nazarene. But then if you go to Isaiah 11 verse 1, all right, Isaiah 11 verse 1, up from the stump of Jesse, from his roots a branch will bear fruit. Now, this is a messianic prophecy saying that that the Messiah will be the branch, the root of Jesse. Jesse is the father of David, and David, through many generations, of course, is the father of Jesus. And the word branch is Nazar. And see, Jesus was born in a town called Branch. All right? And basically, literally, Jesus was born in Branch. And of course, they called Branch. In fact, one of the things they called the early church was the Nazarenes. That Jesus will be called the Nazarene. And it's right here in Isaiah 11, verse and also in Zechariah 9 through 15. And these examples are examples not of a contradiction in the Bible, but of the opponents of the Bible just not understanding the Bible. That's the problem. And what they should do is they should take the time to understand the Bible. But now, in a discussion with a Muslim about the Quran and the Bible, then you probably should understand the Quran. You may want to eventually read it. And you should treat the Quran the way you wished they would treat the Bible. Not trying to find contradictions that aren't really there. Okay, got it? All right. And then there's the prophecy in Matthew, out of Egypt I will call my son. All right? And they'll say, that prophecy is not about Jesus, if you go back there. That prophecy is a statement about Israel being called out of Egypt. But again, they don't understand that there's the idea. Yes, it's true that if you read Hosea 11, verse 1, if you read it, it's talking about the fact that God took Israel out of slavery in Egypt. And in the Bible, that's a foreshadow or a prefigure. In other words, when God called Israel out of Egypt, that's a prefigure of God calling Jesus out of Egypt. It's a prefigure of God calling us out of Egypt. So it's not a false prophecy, it's a misunderstanding by the critics. Where Matthew says in Isaiah 7, it says the virgin will be with child. Okay? And they'll say, that's the what? That's not what Isaiah 7 says. Well, actually, that is what Isaiah 7 says. Actually, Isaiah 7 says is the young woman will be with child. And, you know, young women can be non-virgins. It's possible. But really, again, this is just silly criticism. Because if you go to Isaiah 7, the Lord will give you a sign. Now, if a married woman has a child, would that be a sign? If a young married woman had a child, would that be a miraculous sign? No. So, obviously, it's talking about a virgin being with child. In fact, the well over 200 years before Jesus was born, it translates the Hebrew of Isaiah 7, virgin. And Matthew arguably is quoting the Septuagint, which says virgin. So again, this criticism is simply not valid. We could go on and on and on. But I think it's more examples, very common claims that the Bible has contradictions. It simply doesn't. Here's a bunch of other ones, all right? We're going to do this as a thing. It's good practice. We don't have time now. But I'm telling you, these are all claimed contradictions that came to my website. Somebody said the Bible is not inspired. And you could try it. I think you'll find a really common example is the resurrection accounts. The resurrection accounts are very different. And they'll say they contradict. Create a unified account of all the resurrection accounts, all of them in together, which doesn't contradict, you just prove this claim is not correct. And that's been done by a number. The fact is, if you have different... All the accounts were identical. So the fact that the different... The fact is, there's one breaking his chains, and the pigs going to the water, and there's some other guy who's just kind of just there, you know. So one writer doesn't bother to mention it. These are these contradictions. Okay, I think that's enough on that. All right, now just a little bit more on inspiration. All right. The sons many. And there are so many, there are at least 60 different authors in the Bible. And yet the theme is the same throughout. It's amazing. The theological unity of the Bible. There are Egyptians, Bedouins, Greeks, priests, farmers, soldiers, kings, fishermen, prophets, prime ministers, historians, poets, seers, and teachers. All those different kinds of people writing the Bible. And the fact that there's one unchanging message throughout is powerful evidence that it's inspired. And then the fact that the entire Old Testament, from beginning to end, is all a unified story about Jesus, that's mind-blowing. I talked about some of that yesterday. Okay? I believe, this is just my opinion, that the Bible is the preeminent book on ecology ever written. It is the preeminent book on how to teach ever written. It is the greatest literature ever written. It offers the greatest wisdom ever written. It offers the greatest philosophy ever written. It's the greatest character and ethics ever written. It offers the greatest wisdom on child raising. It offers the greatest wisdom on finances ever written, etc., etc., etc. So, sorry about God, okay? But, you know, I think we should offer this as evidence to other people. Okay, great. Our next lesson is going to be on history, archaeology, and Bible. All right? See, my voice is getting slightly better as I'm talking. It sounded terrible at first, didn't it? What's going to happen is it's going to get better, and then it's going to get worse. That's what's going to happen. I know from experience. So pray for my voice. Okay. I'm not going to be wandering away from the microphone today, that's for sure. All right. Now, remember we talked about different areas of Christian evidence. All right? And some of these are useful for helping to convert people to Christ. And some are really, honestly, more to our younger Christians and to ourselves, of course, to guard our faith, right? To sort of have an undergirding to our faith. I don't think you're going to show a picture of, I don't know, the ziggurat and people are going to go, yeah, man, I need to become a Christian. You know, so history archaeology is evidence of a different sort. So probably you might include a messianic prophecy study when you're studying with people. Probably you're not going to use this material when you're converting people, okay? But I do think it's important to support our faith. Now, Christianity, also Judaism, is the only religion in the world which is immersed in history. Really, the Bible is a story. From beginning to end, it's a unified story. All right? Let me give you the short version of the Bible. Okay? I'm going to summarize the whole Bible. All right, here we go. Genesis 1. God created everything, and it was all good. Genesis 2. God created human beings in order that he could love them, so that they could love him and love one another. Genesis 3 through Genesis 11, we messed up really, really badly. We lost our problem. 12 through Revelation 20, God is fixing the problem. Revelation 21 and God fixed the problem. Okay? And it's the story of first God choosing a man. His name was Abraham. And then creating a people from that man. And then giving them a place and kings and prophets and a covenant. All the things preparing for his great work of salvation, which is to send Jesus. Okay? So the Bible is immersed in history. And if that history is not true, now that's a problem for the Bible. For example, what if there was no person Abraham? What if he wasn't even a real person? Well, that would be a problem. I mean, Christianity doesn't really... Abraham has to be a real person. To give you a feeling for it, just in the first three chapters of Joshua, just in those three chapters, it mentions 12 cities. It mentions 10 different peoples, like the Hittites, the Hivites, Amorites, Jebusites, etc. And, I'm sorry, 10 different specific individual people, Joshua and Caleb, and then 7 people, such as the Hittites, the Hivites. Now, there's really only two possibilities. Either those places actually existed, and those peoples actually existed, or they didn't. And here's what the critics and skeptics are going to call a fable. It's all a story made up by 4th and 5th century BC Jews trying to get their kids to obey them. All right? And so what they'll do is they'll say it's all a fable. Here's the approach they take. They say, none of it is true. Then you show them that this thing is true. They say, well, it's all not true except that one. Then you show them this other thing to be true. Well, it's all not true except those two. Then you... They say it's all not true except those 26 things. Now, this is very bad reasoning. And yet it's called the minimalist approach. Now, to some extent, the job of an archaeologist is to be a minimalist, honestly. Because the archaeologist's job is to only acknowledge archaeological things that are actual. So they will not say such and such happened according to archaeology until they know that it happened according to archaeology. So that's what they should do. Our archaeologists ought to be skeptical when it comes to archaeology, all right? However, what they shouldn't do is dismiss the inspiration of the Bible. That principle to anything other than the Bible. It's funny how that works. Okay. All right, we can divide the Bible into different periods. By the way, before Abraham, that's prehistory. Before Abraham, these are things that are very, very difficult to place the time or the location. That's just true. I believe they happened, but I don't believe we will ever have archaeological evidence for Adam and Eve and Methuselah and these people. So looking for this kind of thing, you know, people trying to look for the Noah's Ark, this is a waste of time. All right, but from the time of we have historical markers. We can know where it happened, and we can know when it happened within 100 years or two. So our question about history, archaeology, and the Bible begins with Abraham. Got it? So there's the time of the patriarchs. Now, during the patriarchal period, where does the Bible take place? Where? I can't hear you.
Ancient Near East.
From Ur. But where? Can you narrow it? Near East. All right. Can you narrow it, please?
From Ur.
Ur, okay. Ur. Where's Ur? Mesopotamia. So there, so got it? So the book of Genesis is placed in Mesopotamia. So therefore, the information in there should fit the setting of Mesopotamia, roughly 2000 BC. And by the way, that's exactly what it is. Okay, got it? And then there's the period of the Exodus. This information should agree with the culture of Egypt, roughly 1500 BC. And it does. Then we have the period of the Judges, the United Kingdom, the Divided Kingdom. Now, if we go through the entire history in the Bible, where along that path should we begin to be able to find actual archaeological objects? Where, from the time of Abraham to the end of the Old Testament, Patriarchs, Exodus, the Judges, United Kingdom, Divided Kingdom, where should we start to have actual physical objects? Not during the Exodus. What were the Jews like at that time? Rich or poor?
Poor.
Did they have huge buildings? Did they have great possessions? They were completely poverty-stricken slaves. People say there's no historical evidence of the Jews in Egypt at that time. My response is, it's true, and of course there isn't. Of course there isn't. You know, what would you find? The foundation of a house? All right? What about Abraham? Did he have some kind of building you could find? He lived in a tent. So let me ask the question again. When you hear the answer, you're going to go, oh, that's right, I should have known, okay? So where in this history should we start to have physical remains? United Kingdom. And by the way, that's exactly when we start to have physical remains. All right? To say that these things didn't happen because we don't have physical remains is to demand something that's impossible. What kind of demand is that? Got it? So, let's start to look at some of the okay. So first of all, if we talk about the time of Genesis, Genesis has Abraham being born in Ur. And when you read it, you get the sense that Ur is a very, very large, prosperous city. Yes? And then from Ur, he went to Haran, which seems to be kind of on the outskirts of civilization, sort of an outskirts city, probably smaller, maybe not with such a long history. Sure enough, we know where it is, and it was probably the largest city in the entire world at that time. Similarly, Haran. Haran is a smaller city. It would be in northeast Syria today, on the outskirts of Mesopotamia. Haran was abandoned roughly 1600 BC. Now, the critics of the Bible say that Genesis was written maybe 600 BC. At that time, Haran had not even existed for 1,000 years. So why would the writer of Genesis mention a city that nobody had ever even heard of? The fact that they would do this really doesn't even make any sense. Okay? A couple more examples. There are the Ebla tablets. Also, what we'd call Syria today, they found several 1,000 tablets. Now, most of these tablets are mundane things like lists of things that were sold and trade goods and things like that and government documents. But some of the names found in the Ebla tablets are Terug, Abram, and Sarai. These four people are not the four people in the Bible. What this shows is names in Mesopotamia 2000 BC include Nahor, Terug, Abram, and Sarai. Now, were those names that people had in Palestine in the year 800 BC? Of course not. Nobody had heard those names for centuries. All right? So again, what we see is evidence that the book of Genesis contains materials that come from Mesopotamia, roughly 2000 BC. Now, there's an interesting story in Genesis 31. Jacob left Laban, and he took his two wives and his concubines and all their stuff, and stole the idols. Okay? Chases them down, not to get his daughters back, his cattle and livestock back, but to get his idols back. Now, that's a really weird story. But they found in Mesopotamia that says, whoever holds the seraphim receives the inheritance. In other words, whoever has these idols gets to inherit all the goods of the father. Oh, okay. Now I get it. Again, this is a tradition which only makes sense, and the book of Genesis only makes sense if it was a document containing valid materials from Mesopotamia from roughly 2000 BC. And the point is this. Information, exactly what you have. Do these critics of the Bible notice this? It just misses them entirely. And to me, that's interesting. Okay, next, we have cities. Okay? Interesting. Because in the book of Genesis, farmland was down there by the Dead Sea. Right? Now, if you go there today, you would say, God, I mean, have you been to the Dead Sea? It is as arid and virtually completely abandoned land as it has been from time immemorial. So it describes a league of five cities, right? That Lot chose the good land where there's good farmland. Now, archaeologists had spent basically zero time studying in the region of the Dead Sea forever because, really, why bother? Well, they should have. Fairly recently, some archaeologists decided to go there. What they found is typical 2000 BC, 2200 BC, what it was back then they had these wadis. Today, these things only have water like in the first few hours after rain and they're dry. But back then, apparently all year. So even though there was very, very little rain there, they had a regular found was massive irrigation works and large farming. Guess how many cities they had. Okay. That's sort of cool. All right, the largest of them is Bab Ed-Dra, which is probably and you can go to the ruins of Sodom. Okay? Now, outside is a and there's cemetery. And the evidence is these wooden structures were burned from the top to the bottom. Generally, when you roughly 2000 BC. But when you burn a city down, you burn it from the bottom to the top, generally. So what we have here is in the broadest sense, God worked an awesome miracle. That area was abandoned. Sort of cool. Now, again, remember the Hittites, Hivites, Girgashites, Jebusites, Canaanites, and all those other ites? Again, made this up. The Hittites are particularly important. All right? The Hittites are mentioned Now, idea that powers at that time were the Hittites and the Egyptians. And yet, well into the 19th century, there was absolutely and then in 19th of Hattusha was found. Large city. And it turns out the Hittite Empire and the Empire in fact it ruled called Iraq and Syria and it was the chief rival of Egypt along with Assyria. Like the Hittites exist. The fact that you can't prove anything doesn't mean it's not true. And if somebody makes a number of claims, and all the ones you can check prove true, and none of them prove untrue, then you assume the others are true. Here's the city gate to the capital of an empire that the skeptics said didn't even exist. You actually get a major papyrus epoch. This manuscript comes from roughly, but it I don't know. I would not say this is proof that these plagues happen, but I find that interesting. All right, now we have the Tel El Amarna letters. A number of these are in the British Museum. For me, going to the British Museum is like being a child in a candy shop. I mean, it's awesome. There are so many artifacts there that reflect So we'll just leave that as, you know, it could be. Anyway, these tablets were written by the ruling little mini kings and princes in Palestine, written to the Pharaoh. Akhenaten, describing things like, you know, commerce and, you know, battles and things. But one of them says the must be the Hebrews. And you know what? In my opinion, the archers never got there. But even if they had, you know, the thing with the locusts and all that, yeah. So it seems to me to imply that it could very well be that this is a record of the Hebrews coming in and conquering the land. The time is right, the place is right, and the historical details are right. Now, the critics of the Old Testament tell you there's very little evidence of massive destruction in Palestine around 1400 BC. And that's true. So they'll say, obviously then, the Jews did not conquer that area at that time. Well, that's not so. There are two major cities that were destroyed at that time. All right? And those cities are, of course, nobody would be too surprised, Jericho. Jericho was destroyed at that time, and Hazor. The archaeologists who studied Hazor, now, according to the book of Joshua, they only destroyed three cities: Jericho, Hazor, and Ai. Now, the location of Ai remains uncertain. But we So the only two cities that have evidence of major destruction at this time are Hazor and Jericho. Well, there you go. But these people seem to not notice this connection. The city was destroyed during the late Bronze Age. It was quite high, consistent with Joshua, and they found grain. So the siege was fairly short at that time. All right? Contrary to what you would expect, the grain wasn't plundered. It seems to have been just left there. All this is consistent with what we know from the book of Joshua. BC. the Stele of Menepta, which mentions the Israelites. Now, before this Stele was discovered, the archaeologist said, oh, there were no Israelites until about 1000 B.C. Then they find this and they say, all right, maybe there were Israelites at 1230 B.C. You know the game they want to play? You know what they should do? The Bible is the most accurate historical document of the ancient world. By far. And this is a fact. Think about it. All the other ancient historians, all they recorded was the victories. No defeats. You would think nobody ever lost a battle. Does the Bible record any defeats of the Israelites?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The other accounts, their leaders are like perfect. You know? And so, again, kind of an amateur historian. I know a lot of history. I'm not an archaeologist at all. But to me, I mean, a simple view of the evidence says the Bible is the most accurate and reliable source of historical evidence from the ancient world, bar none, end of story, period. Why don't they notice this? Now, I'm just getting into the really awesome stuff. I'm kind of near the end of my lesson, but now we're going to get to go. By the way, they found this city. And this city had not been excavated until, I think, about 15 or 20 years ago. So David mentions the fortified city built in the desert. There it is. From guess when? 1000 B.C. And it's clearly a Jewish city. All right. But we've been going for almost an hour, so we need our 8 to 10 minute break. Okay?